The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha. Welcome to this very special edition of Science Weekly, live from the Faraday Lecture Theatre in London. Now, this show is dedicated to a fundamental, crucial, irreplaceable part of the joy that I'm sure we all feel for science, demonstrations. And where better to talk about demonstrations than this fine lecture theatre? This place is a testament to the history of the science demonstration. From Michael Faraday to J.J. Thompson to countless Christmas lectures, for generations, the Royal Institution has been the place where demonstrations have famously entertained, enlightened, and, well, let's face it, endangered people as well. In fact, I'm going to let you in on a bit of a secret. When we were planning to record this, we thought we'd just do a normal podcast with interviews and guests and discussions about the latest news. But you know, it's actually a law that you can't stand in this spot for more than 15 minutes without doing a demonstration. Bad things happen otherwise. I'm sure there's demonstration police somewhere. Fortunately, I'm going to be joined by a parade of brilliant demonstrators to help me fulfill these ancient laws. We're going to have two of the Royal Institution's great and good, head of collections here, Frank James, also Dr. Gail Cardew, who's the Director of Science and Education, the broadcaster, Wellcome Trust Engagement Fellow and serial collector of job titles, Kevin Fong, will also be here, as will his partner in crime, Adam Rutherford, as well as science teacher, Alom Shahar, and Lotto's Labs, Anna Starkey. So let's begin. As Andy sets up, or has set up, our first demo, Andy, by the way, you'll see running around, he's the man who actually gets all the demonstrations done. Let's talk to the man who knows the Royal Institution better than anyone else. Please welcome Professor Frank James.
Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
The first guest. Tell us, how did this room get so famous for being the place for demonstrations?
Well, when the Royal Institution was founded in 1799, it was founded explicitly, or one of its remits was explicitly to promote science to a broad audience, and that required a lecture theatre. This building, 21 Oldmoyle Street, was purchased very soon after the RI was founded. It was a gentleman's townhouse that went back to the beginning of the 18th century. And this room was built at the northern end of the building, designed by Thomas Webster, based on the anatomical lecture theatres you get in medical schools and universities throughout Europe. And even though the original theatre could hold 1,000 people...
This room, yes. Were they smaller?
They were smaller, I think. And also you had benches all the way around, and they didn't worry about health and safety or fire exits or anything.
Neither have we.
They just squeezed 1,000 people in here at times. Then there was an explosion in 1927, which just after Christmas lecture was given, which resulted in this entire space being hollowed out and the current theatre built with safety features like fire exits.
That's pretty good. So in this, either in this room or anywhere else, what's been your favourite science demonstration?
Well, curiously enough, my favourite science demonstration is not actually one done here. It was one done by Galileo in Florence in the early 17th century, where he showed you could pass red wine through water without them mixing and separate them at the top. And the reason why that's my favourite experiment is that it not only demonstrates a very curious phenomenon, in the interwar period, it was believed that people didn't do experiments, that experiments didn't actually help construct scientific knowledge. And so somebody like Alexander Quarry, for example, would say, well, this shows that Faraday didn't do experiments, he was just sort of lying and sort of providing a sort of false idea of knowledge. And this was taught to me when I was studying history of science at Imperial College many years ago, and I looked at it and thought, I'll try it. So I tried it and brought it in the following day, and my professor was extremely impressed that I could actually repeat Galileo's experiments. So Galileo did actually do experiments.
How does it work? You just pour wine through water.
It's a suction effect. You sort of, you release wine at the bottom and it sort of floats without mixing to the top. It's really very impressive when you see it. But that was one of the things that convinced me of the power of experiment in science. And most of my research has been spent working on Faraday, who is, after all, the supreme experimentalist of the
19th century.
We should
talk about Faraday, given that this lecture theatre is named after him.
That's right, yeah.
So what kinds of things was he doing in here?
Faraday made his fundamental discoveries of things like the electric motor, electric transformer, electric generator, the diamagnetism down in the basement laboratories of the Royal Institution. And one of Faraday's magnetic laboratories is still there, so you can go down and see it afterwards. And it made its part way up to this theatre where he demonstrated those fundamental physical properties. And indeed, on one occasion in early 1836, he built the world's first Faraday cage in this very room, a 12-foot by 12-foot by 12-foot cage, in which he electrostatically isolated himself from the rest of the universe and was able then to show in the Faraday cage that what you saw as electric charge depended on your own electrical state. In other words, the observer affected what was observed, which is one of the sort of earliest statements of relativity principle.
OK, well, that's clearly not the experiment we're doing right here. What have you set up? What have you brought for us here?
Well, this is an experiment that was developed by Humphrey Davy in the early 19th century. Davy was really the first person who developed the Royal Institution's lecture programme and turned Old Mile Street outside into the first one-way street in London on lecture nights.
Because of the queues.
Because of the queues, and lectures were so popular, all the carriages caused such a congestion in Old Mile Street that the police made it into a one-way street, but only on lecture nights, I have to say. What Dave was trying to do here was to try and work out a way of distinguishing the various theories of heat that existed in the early 19th century, and there were about three theories. One that was a fluid, which they called caloric, which is simply the French for heat, and that's sort of a bit tautological, but that's the way the French thought about heat at that point. then you had the idea that heat was a mode of motion. That was an idea developed by Benjamin Thompson, Count Mumford, who was also associated with the Royal Institution. And then you had the idea that heat was like light. That it behaved and followed the laws of optics of reflection and refraction and so on. And this is what this experiment
does. So let's just describe this. You've got two what look like sort of mini satellite dishes which are silvered, one of which has a bit of cotton wool in the centre.
Gun cotton.
Gun cotton in the centre. And they're about 4 metres apart. What do you do with these two curious-looking things?
Well, Andy will put a heat source at the focus of this mirror, and the heat will then be reflected onto that mirror, and all being well, you'll see the garden cotton.
Well, it should do something interesting.
Yes.
At some point soon. It's getting extremely bright, first of all, and this is what we're expecting to see so far, is it?
Yes.
There's nothing untoward happening so far. I'm just hoping that...
There we are.
Well done, audience.
Frank. And that's pretty convincing evidence at the time that heat was very much like light.
Which means that it could be refracted and reflected and condensed and moved across.
That's right.
This thing has completely disappeared.
It's gone.
Am I allowed to touch this? Or would that be a bad idea?
Andy, that's not going to be hot, is it? Or is it?
No, good. Ow. Okay, well, I think that's the end of that. Frankie, thank you very much,
okay.
Frank.
You're welcome.
Take care. You can sort of still smell that, and at some point, smell podcasts will be available, and you'll smell Cordite's more dangerous than that. Okay, well, from an optical combustion to an optical illusion, get it? we're going to be focusing on the brain for a few moments now. To explain these demonstrations, I'm going to be joined by the woman who has the intriguing job title of Director of Impossible Projects at the Science Museum's Lotto Lab. Please welcome Anna Starkey.
Oh,
Anna, with a job title like that, what's your job satisfaction like?
Enormous. And the good thing about it is, because they're impossible projects, if I can't pull them off, then I haven't failed.
So did you get to choose your own job title, or is it something foisted upon you, which is a long line of impossible project directors?
No, there hasn't been a long line. I believe I'm the first in the line of impossible project directors. It was suggested by Beau Lotto, who is the director of Lotto Lab. When he came up with it, I didn't disagree.
So tell us a bit about Lotto Lab. It's in the Science Museum.
It is, yeah.
And in fact, they're on now, tonight.
They're on now, yeah. As we sit here, Lotto Lab is doing experiments on hundreds of people coming through the Science Museum late. We're a public neuroscience research laboratory, which means that we do neuroscience research, and particularly into human perception. And the public bit is that we really try and include the public in our experiments. So we're not just doing stuff behind a closed door, hence why we're in the Science Museum. We're actually independent, but they're very kindly hosting us there at the moment. So all the visitors that come through come and take part in stuff.
Are the experiments falling apart tonight because you're not there?
I really hope not. No, they won't be.
They've not been texting you. Desperately.
No, I got a text saying everything was in order. No, we've got an amazing team of volunteers that come and run the experiments for us. So there's all sorts of stuff going on there tonight, and we've got an amazing jazz trio that are going to be... They've based their music on brainwaves that they've recorded, their own brainwaves, and then they've composed music around that.
So. Jazz, nice.
Well,
let's see your demonstration. You've brought three of your demos tonight.
Yes.
You're going to lead this bit, so I'm just going to stand there being... a party to this, so lead away.
All right, well, the first demonstration is... thank you very much, wonderful. Props arrive, just like magic. This is what happens when you're in the Faraday Theatre. Thank you. The first one that I've got is essentially to demonstrate the amazing ability of our brains to redefine normality and redefine our perception of the world. And it's incredible and remarkable how quickly they can do this. So, in the tradition of a good science demo, I need a volunteer, preferably someone with good hand-eye coordination or thereabouts. This young gentleman in the front row, would you like to come down?
Come down.
Come on through. Round of applause. What's your name?
Shivam.
Very nice to meet you. Now, what I would very much love you to do, to start off with, is take this ball and come and stand.
So what we've got there is a green sort of spongy, well, like rubbery ball.
It's a green rubbery ball.
You've got some glasses in your hand. What are they?
I have. I'm going to put them on in just a moment. But if you stand here...
Okay, I'm the target.
Yeah, if you could become a target and just hold your hands like this. Try and resist the impulse to try and catch the ball.
You've got to try and get it into the target.
Now, if you could throw the ball at Alok, try to miss
his
face. and don't do it too hard.
That's all I've got.
Yeah, and just see if you can make it land in his hands.
Throw his face.
Perfect.
Oh, I moved my hand, I'm sorry.
Just about, I think that was close enough.
That's close enough.
So, what I'm going to do now is pop these glasses on.
The ball started flashing, is that right?
The ball, the flashing ball, that's not to do with the experiment. It's just, I thought, bring a really camp ball.
Okay.
Thanks.
So, I'm still in the same place.
You're still in the same place. You haven't moved, just keeping your hands still. Shivam, I now need you to try and throw the ball again to land in Alok's hands.
And you've now got some glasses on, which look brilliant, by the way.
So, just throw the ball now, see what happens. Fantastic. Now, stay there. You're doing brilliantly.
As if I would have thrown that ball.
Now, we'll notice that he missed to the right. What's happening is he's got prism glasses on, and these prism glasses are shifting the light that's coming into his eyes by 20 degrees to the right. So it's not your fault that you missed 20 degrees to the right. Keep having a go and seeing if you can land...
Also, it's not my fault that I missed
catching it. No, it's not your fault you missed catching it. Keep having a go and see if you can land this ball in Alok's hands. Okay, that was a little bit closer. Very good. So what's happening? Keep going. What's happening is that his brain is starting. Have another go. His brain is starting to adapt to the new normal.
No, it isn't. Well, it really isn't.
Brilliant. There's the demo. Or not. Some of us adapt quicker than others. Have another go. Bear in mind that everything is shifted over to the right. and see if you can get it closer to Alok's hands this time. What happens? Keep going as you go through. I'll stand over here to catch the ball. What's amazing about our brains? Have another throw. See if you can get it. Oh, there you go. Have another go. Our brains actually start to redefine. Look, we're getting closer. Come on. It's important that we get this close enough because our brain is operating with a new reality.
Ooh.
Oh, that's there
good.
We go. Now, just try throwing it one more time to hit Alec. So what happened there is your brain is still operating to your perceived reality of everything being shifted to the right.
Let's just check. The glasses off, now the ball's going to my right, a bit too much.
Yes, so let's just check that you've gone back to normal before I send you back to your seat.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good enough. Thank you very much.
Round of applause. Thank you very much. Thank you. Anna's now going to actually literally have to run off the Science Museum to make sure that experiment's working over there. Our next guest is a Master of Science Demonstration. I think that's actually a job title and qualification. He has what you might call a magical touch. Please welcome the teacher, filmmaker, and professional young angry man, Alom Shahar. Wait for your table to turn up, first of all. It's all going a bit crazy. What's happened there? We've broken Anna's experiment. Come out here. Let's talk about your demonstration. Well, before we talk about it, you're a teacher. What's your favourite science demo? You've done loads of these in the past. Now you refuse to call yourself a science demo person. But what is your favourite science demo?
I'm going to show the audience my favourite science demo.
Oh, so it's actually going to happen?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right, okay. Now, you're a teacher. Do you use demos in schools? How important are they?
I do use demos in school, and Anna's touched on some of the things that I think are problematic about demos. A lot of the time, people do demos in schools and in lecture theatres and as part of science communication shows, and what it actually is doing is entertaining the audience. There's a lot of kind of, wow, look at this, it's spectacular. So,
are you entertained?
No. Yeah. Tonight, clearly, they've taken a different approach.
They're learning.
And one of the best things about science demos is that they are entertaining. But in a way, that's also part of the problem with them, because children particularly can get lost in just the entertainment bit. And in fact, lots of teachers think that all they need to do is show the phenomenon and then explain it, which is actually what's been happening to some extent tonight. And what is often happening is not teaching or learning, but something that some people are starting to refer to as pseudo-teaching. And what pseudo-teaching is a form of teaching whereby the teacher thinks they're doing some teaching, the students think they're doing some learning, and outside observers looking at the lesson would think, there's some learning going on there. But actually, if you then examine the students, you find that they haven't learnt whatever it is you thought you were trying to teach them. And that's a danger that's particularly there when you're doing demonstrations. The practice of showing something and then explaining how it works only works for a tiny minority of people. So demonstrations where people come along and they do something spectacular and then they say, this is Newton's third law in action, blah, 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 quantum mechanics, boom, right?
Well, if you said blah, 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 quantum mechanics, right. That makes no sense. Of course it wouldn't. What are you talking about?
But that's actually a very poor way of going about using demonstrations in the classroom.
Well, you're not going to do that now.
I actually am going to do that.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to do it.
Well, you're
to,
really good. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. I think all you have to do is as a teacher, is think about doing demonstrations in a very different context. How you should do a demonstration in the classroom is, I think, like this. For example,
well, wait a minute. Let me just ask you to do it first of all.
Sure.
You might as well. Should I just sit down? No, this is actually just a pseudo podcast recording. Actually,
yes.
Everyone outside thinks we're recording a podcast. Everyone here thinks we are. We are. It's nothing's going to be recorded. Actually. Okay. Now do your demo.
Okay.
There you go.
It's probably the wrong kind of audience to do this with, but I've got a battery. It's an ordinary battery. I've got a neodymium magnet, which you can buy off the internet, and I've got a piece of copper wire. And most of you will know that copper is not attracted to magnets. I'm just going to stick the magnet onto the bottom of the battery, and then I'm going to stick the wire on top of the battery. And at this point in my class, I would ask the students what they think is going to happen. So I would ask them to predict what is going to happen.
So what is
anybody care to make a prediction who isn't a physicist? Who is that?
Did someone say something?
Someone says...
What's
going to spin? Okay, so she's made a prediction. I'd next ask you to explain your prediction.
That wasn't fair.
It's being on Faraday's.
Okay, so she's clearly not in year 7, right? But the reason why I would ask my students to predict what's going to happen is to check their understanding of what's come before. So this demonstration, this phenomenon, relies on electricity and magnetism. And in order to predict what's going to happen if you haven't seen it before, would require an understanding of how electricity and magnetism work. So by asking a child to predict what's going to happen and then asking them to explain their prediction, I'm testing their understanding. We then observe what actually happens, and so we're going to test her prediction.
People over there might not be able to see.
And it's tiny.
Basically, he's putting the Mac on there.
There you go, there's a new.
Let me try it over there, have a look. Let's stop. Okay. Just explain what you did there for the people who can't see what just happened.
Okay, and maybe that's not as spectacular as things blowing up and whatnot, but that's actually really magical if you've never seen it before.
It's not okay? Physics.
Okay, there is a piece of wire that was not magnetic. It's sitting on top of a battery and it's spinning of its own accord. Okay, this is a very simple electric motor, and this phenomenon was first discovered by Michael Faraday in this very building. Now, going back to my very smart student up there, your prediction was correct and your explanation was also correct. However, in the classroom, it's highly unlikely that an 11-year-old would necessarily get that correct. But if they did, great, it would demonstrate understanding. So this very simple technique, predict, observe, explain, makes using demonstrations in teaching far more powerful.
Are you sure you don't want to do this full time, then? This sort of thing?
No. And the other reason why I love...
No.
The other reason why I love this demonstration is because it's actually part of a pair of demonstrations. A kind of sister effect of this is the generation of electricity by taking a piece of wire and moving it in a magnetic field. And that simple discovery in this building, you know, changed our world. And I think, you know, putting stuff in front of young people that changed our world literally is quite exciting.
Excellent. Oh, thank you very much indeed. Okay, well, behind me on the demo table, we're going to start setting up another experiment. And to explain exactly what's going to happen, I'm joined by a great friend of Science Weekly. He's a Wellcome Trust Engagement Fellow, anaesthetist, lecturer, broadcaster, soon-to-be author, and probably at some point soon, cult leader, Kevin Fong. Before we get to this, whatever it is, you've been doing crazy demonstrations on screen for a while. What's your most enjoyable, memorable, crazy experiment?
Well, I mean, it's quite nice of the BBC to stick me in the back of the Vomit Comet and fly me around France for a while. That was good fun. But my favourite demonstration ever, I think, is one of my physiology lectures was trying to demonstrate how the brain is subdivided into anatomically distinct areas which have different function. And that's all driven by electrophysiology, so currents running through the brain. So you can basically stun the brain by getting an electromagnetic coil, induction coil, holding it over your brain and giving yourself a bit of a pulse. And you can basically stroke
whilst you're
alive, and you can stroke yourself out. So he sat in front of the lecture theatre talking to us while he ran this coil over his head and gave him a bit of a pulse, and then stopped talking for about 2 minutes because he couldn't. And I thought that was impressive. And quite bold.
That's less demonstration and more sort of willful masochism, yeah. Sadism, or
some sort,
isn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, jackass television meets science. Yeah, it's good. But
well, this experiment, I mean, this demo rather, it's a pig's lung that we've got here. What is it? What are you going to do?
Well, it's demonstrating that dead things smell really bad right now.
It does smell quite bad. Right.
So
it's linked up here to a.
And it's linked up here to a pump. And there's a pump going into the top of the lungs just below the trachea, actually. That's beginning to be where the bronchus is. So the start of the tube that goes into the lungs, and the bicycle pump is going to pump air down, and we're going to see the lungs expand.
Should we get an audience member to pump that?
Let's do that.
Does anyone want to volunteer to pump these lungs?
Preferably someone with a poor sense of smell.
Someone who... There you go. You, why don't you come down? Round of applause, please, for our brave man. Emmanuel, just stand over here. Have we got the... Don't do anything yet. Get your hands on this and get ready. Put your feet on the bottom thing there. Now, are you ready?
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen?
I hope it's going to explode.
You hope it's actually going to explode. Well, I'll just stand over here, in case. Is that your best shirt? Yeah, good. Excellent. Just start pumping that. Can everyone see? Yeah? There we go. Ooh, keep going. Keep going. Be careful. At some point, it will explode if you keep going.
At some point, stop.
There you go. Stop.
Would be my best
advice.
That's
Kevin Fong, who's been in the Vomit Comet and other places, saying stop. Yeah. Kevin, what's going on? That's amazing. It's amazing.
Thank you very much.
Emmanuel, thank you very much. Thanks very much to Emmanuel. And Kevin, surprisingly, the lung inflated.
Surprisingly, the lung inflated. And the fantastic thing about this demonstration is it's a brilliant demonstration of exactly how the lung doesn't work in life. because your lungs don't work like this.
Explain what happened there first.
Other people got explosions and things that span around or bits of Andy Warhol pop out. I get a bicycle pump and a bit of animal. So I feel a bit shortchanged. So the bicycle pump blew air into the lungs, into the air inlet, really, of this pig's lung. And we saw it expand. And actually, what you can't tell from here is this is not a very solid organ. Don't do that. I'm staying right next to it. If you took these lungs and you put them on a bath of water, they would float. This is basically an organ that's full of honeycombed, really, with air sacs, and that's massive, massive surface area. A pair of human lungs, if you open them out, all the alveoli have a surface area of the size of a tennis court, and so that's what that organ does. Now the reason that this isn't how lungs work is because your lungs work by being sat inside your chest, and as you breathe in, your muscles pull your rib cage open, so your ribs are aligned along your chest like bucket handles, and they lift up as you breathe in. Your diaphragm drops down. That increases the volume in your chest. Your lungs sit inside a bag called the pleura. And it sucks the lungs up against the chest wall, pulling the lungs open, like you'd pull open a pair of bellows. And that is what pulls the outside air into your lungs. It generates a lower pressure inside your chest than there is outside. So actually what this demonstrates is that this isn't how a pair of lungs works normally, but it is how we ventilate you if you become sick and you can't breathe for yourself. So normally you breathe by negative pressure. That's called negative pressure ventilation. You generate a negative pressure in your chest with respect to the air outside. This is positive pressure, and this is what we do when we're resuscitating people. We whack a tube into the trachea at the top, and we ventilate by pressing a bag. That bag you see them pressing in episodes of Holby City.
Does that damage anything that way?
Well, that's a very good point. And so we used to think, no. We used to think, well, and all of this, really, this idea of resuscitating people and keeping them going with ventilators, positive pressure ventilators, came out of the polio epidemic in the 1950s when polio paralysed people left their lungs immobile and we had to ventilate them artificially. And for a long time, we didn't think there was any real negative consequence. I mean, it just looks pretty benign. You blow the lungs up, you don't blow them up too much, you let them down. Increasingly, over the years, we've realised that it does damage the lungs. You know, if you're ventilating them in an uncontrolled way, all the shearing forces going across the lung cause inflammation and cause damage to the lungs. And so one of the big, big things that's changed in intensive care over the years is we've learned how not to damage the lungs by ventilating with smaller volumes. So, you know, we can keep you alive with that. It's not forever.
Are there better ways of doing it, or is it just a case of volume? Is it drugs? What other ways can you use?
So
intensive care is something that is, you know, been developing only in the last few decades, really.
It's about 60 years old now. Before we did this positive pressure ventilation stuff, there was negative pressure ventilation. That's the old iron lungs that you may have seen, where people sat inside this thing with a collar up here, and it sucked their chest out, doing pretty much what you do in real life. But of course, you know, they're very big and very cumbersome. More recently, and especially with the flu epidemics, they've been looking at other ways of ventilating very, very sick people. And one of those is to not try and reproduce what the body's doing at all, but to oscillate a column of air down the windpipe there and just keep the lungs permanently inflated. So the lungs are doing less opening and closing, so they're less prone to get damaged. That's called high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. And it's quite a bizarre thing to watch, actually, and it's quite experimental. So that might be a better method. And the final other method is something called ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. And what that is essentially it's a bypass circuit, but instead of bypassing the heart, you're bypassing the lungs. So you literally take the blood out of their body, you put it in an oxygenator that sits by the bedside, and you stick it back in them. But it's not clear whether either of those is going to help.
Are you going to try any of those in your next TV programme?
I'm going to try it here now with you.
Are you? Yeah. I'm really, really,
I just have
really
a large needle over
there. Squeamish about needles. So if you want me to actually inject you with something, that would be quite dangerous. Kevin, thank you so much.
No worries.
While that particularly smelly pig lung is being moved away, if you want it afterwards, I'm not sure what's going to happen to the pig lung. Maybe they can, someone can have it, probably? Yeah. I don't know. If you want it for a pie or something, it's yours. We're going to hear a bit more about the Royal Institution now and the things, kinds of things it does. So please welcome Dr. Gail Cardew, who's the institution's Director of Science and Education. Gail, thanks very much for letting us be here, first of all, do these slightly crazy demos. You've probably done much worse here, frankly. The most famous thing about this room and the Royal Institution is probably the Christmas lectures. Most people here have seen them every year around Christmas, obviously. Where did they start? What was the sort of idea behind them?
So Michael Faraday started them in 1825, and he first put forward a programme of activities for young people in science, when there really wasn't anything in science happening for young people. So he was the very first person to think science shouldn't be just in the realm of the grown-ups and should actually we should be trying to inspire young people about science. So he put forward this programme which he called the Juvenile Lectures that happened around Christmas.
They sound like something I would go to now, to be honest with you. This might be one of them.
And I think it was that he had lectures not just at Christmas but other times of the year, but the Christmas lectures ones really kind of stood out. And there's a really, if you get a chance on the when you leave, on the other side of this wall here is one of my favourite objects in the Royal Institution. It's a picture of Michael Faraday giving a Christmas lecture in 1855, and he's pointing to this sort of demonstration, which is sort of blocks of different kind of objects, and he's demonstrating the concept of density. And the actual demo is underneath the picture outside. So you can see his demo with his handwriting just inside. It's just a really nice thing to think that over all these years that the institution has kept that demo. It's nice.
There's more than a century of Christmas lectures have happened since, and nearly every great scientist that people have heard of here has done one at some point. How have they changed over the years? I mean, in the last few years, they're incredibly slick things. They're not just, there's not, in the olden days, I remember there was a table here and people would sort of lecture from this table, maybe with some slides or images or something. Last year, Bruce Hood did essentially where you turn this whole thing into a horror set. I mean, they're very different things now.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that when we refurbished the lecture theatre, the removal of this desk, which wasn't, people think it's Faraday's original desk, it wasn't.
Don't
it
was, say that!
It was a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. Because things get blowing up, right? We kept doing these experiments. And there'd be these holes and kind of, you know, singed bits around the edges. So it was no doubt that when we refurbished the lecture theatre, we asked permission from English Heritage if we could actually chop it into three bits and take it out. And it's given us this flexibility to be able to kind of move in sets and kind of do an elaborate set design. And it's enabled us to be able to do stuff that's much more theatrical and kind of bigger in scale in this small space. So
what's been your favourite demo in history? You've probably got loads to choose from.
I do. And I've been thinking about this because I did know you were going to ask this question. And actually, my favourite demos are the ones that get the most reaction out of the audience. And last year, and I don't think it looks like I'm cheating that I've just actually thought about last year's, but there was one demo last year where Bruce stood here and there was a couple of scientists that came down from Newcastle, I think, and they had a live locust and they turned the locust upside down and embedded him in some plasticine and sort of stuck little plastic kind of bands around him so that he wouldn't move. And they put a little piece of wire in him. And when Bruce moved his hand towards the locust eyes on one side, you could hear this coming from the monitor. And what was actually happening was that you could see you could hear the neurons firing, because locusts have these kind of anti-collision kind of sensors. And it's so when something comes close to them, their neurons start firing. So he was demonstrating this, and because we had a live animal in the audience that was kind of upside down and looked a bit sort of weird, we didn't know how the experiment was going to go down. Some of us in the preparation stage were thinking, should we do this? Should we not do this? What's the audience reaction going to be? We're not really sure. And when he was doing it, I guarantee all the kids in the lecture theatre were sitting forward like this, just like looking, and it was just amazing. And then when it was aired on TV, it was the point in which the Christmas lectures were trending on Twitter. So it had this kind of real big reaction in people.
See, that thing about locusts is interesting because the researcher who found out that these the locusts have that sort of sensibility, that sense, actually won an Ig Nobel Prize, I think, to remember, because this guy showed locusts Star Wars, and especially the bit where the X-Wing sort of flies towards the screen to see what the locust would do and how it sort of avoids collisions in these massive swarms. I mean, there is a genuine bit of science going on there, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And do you know what? These people were saying that they're doing it because, these scientists were saying they were doing it because of one day thinking that they could somehow use it in anti-collision vehicles.
In cars. Yeah. I think Volvo, in fact, have paid for that research to happen. Gail, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so we're about to set up the last demonstration for the evening. To help me explain it, please welcome Adam Rutherford. Adam, welcome.
Hello.
Now, we are going to do another demonstration at this point, so I think we're ready for it, Andy, if you want to start setting it up. But you're a journalist. Let's talk about... We always talk about news on this podcast. So what are you looking over there for? Look over here, just for a second. Let's just talk about some news stories, shall we? What's been going on in nature?
I feel like I should have some sort of blinkers on
We'll come to that.
Right.
So, what's been going on in nature? Have you published any interesting papers recently?
Are you going to ask me about monkey feet?
This one.
Right.
Yes, sorry.
Ask me a specific question.
There was a paleontologist who found 8 foot bones, I believe. Just stop looking over there. All right, why don't you explain what's happening?
This is actually a scene from The Wizard of Oz, isn't it? Well, whatever happens, don't look at the man behind the curtain.
What's happening? Why don't you explain what's happening?
I don't know what's happening. This is the first time I've seen this. I don't know what the demonstration is.
Okay, well, like any good science demo collection,
yeah,
we have to use liquid nitrogen
right.
for something. So it's basically that's this. That's our fulfillment.
So this chap's putting liquid nitrogen into a bottle and he's sealing the top. Now, I may be a biologist,
but
I see where this is going.
He's sealing the top. I'm not going to ruin it for everyone who's here, or even watching the video afterwards or listening, when I say that it's going to be quite spectacular. Right. And
you don't need to be Brian Cox to work out that this isn't going to end well for me.
You wanted a demo, right? Anyway, let's talk about your news story. So he's put the ping pong balls on top of the thing. Do you want to walk over here?
I'm just...
Should we just
turn in my chair.
Why don't we just stand over here?
Yeah.
So what's happened is that the liquid nitrogen has been put into a sealed bottle at the bottom of a tube, and there's ping pong balls on top. Just ignore it. Nothing's going to happen yet. So in Ethiopia, apparently, they discovered some fossil bones. Tell us about those. Tell us about bones.
Right, so new discovery just published about 2 hours ago was the discovery in Ethiopia of a foot that dates back to 3.4 million years ago. And it's the exact same time and place that Lucy, one of the most iconic fossils in human evolution, was found in the 1970s. Now, what's interesting about this is that this foot has an opposable toe on it. And Lucy was an upright walker like us. And bipedalism, walking on 2 feet, is something that is unique to humans. So, for a long time, we've been... So for a long time we've been thinking about bipedalism being... you want me to keep going?
Yes!
Bipedalism is a key moment in our evolution, that because we're the only species of Homo that does it, it's considered to be a really important step. Now, Lucy, that iconic fossil, was the first bipedal pre-Homo to be discovered, an Australopithecus afarensis is what she was. This new foot is from the
is
same
it a new
time.
Species?
Is it a new species? We can't say yet, and by that we can't say, what I mean is we're not allowed to say.
But yes, just is it a new species?
It's 8 bones from a foot, which is not enough to say that it's a new species. However, it doesn't fit into any known species from that time or from any other time. So you work it out for yourselves.
OK, should we talk about the experiment, the demo? What happened there?
I was just, like, standing
here. Just come
here.
Over here, come over here. There's nothing in there now. So this tube, the bang you heard, obviously,
right.
For people who couldn't see this, there was a bang. All the ping pong balls flew out. I hope some of you in the audience have got them. There's a bit of a mess on the floor right now.
Yep.
What happened?
Well, you know I'm a biologist, so I'm going to give you a biologist's
explanation.
Yeah,
go for it. Yeah, I want to know. Well, you know, sometimes you see an event and you have to sort of try and describe it. So
right. So all living things are made of cells, and what was packed in this is right, isn't it?
I think this is one of them. Yeah, go
so
on.
Packed inside there were a bunch of
cells,
and
there was some gene code.
Yeah, the pink represents proteins.
So what happened? Was this alive?
Briefly. There was a massive expulsion of energy and...
You're being heckled by Kevin Fong over there.
I've got to heckle at this point.
Kevin, do you want to come down and explain actually what happened?
I'd rather discuss a physics experiment.
Well, you've got a physics degree, so why don't you explain
it? Full disclosure, you spent the entirety of your lecture on Wikipedia. He can't even spell hominid. It's terrible. It's setting science communication back decades.
Kevin, why don't you explain what happened here?
Well...
Yes, good.
I should say, for the record, that was true. I was looking up what the definition of a hominin was.
Just for fun, not even for this. Go for it.
He didn't even finish medical school. Have I said that before? Anyway, I'll buy you a fight later.
Harry Hill isn't on anymore. We should definitely have a fight.
Yeah.
I'm going to PhD, so that makes me a proper doctor.
Okay, boys, you can do this afterwards. Kevin, please.
Did I just get a higher degree after? That was awful. Okay, so look. Basically, it's... I'm not sure how it works. So it's a critical temperature problem. So what you've done is you've taken liquid nitrogen in its liquid form. I think that's right. If it's wrong, just don't...
There is a physics teacher here.
Oh, yeah, no, that's true. I've got a degree in physics.
There's a double hackle going on here.
He does hold several more degrees than anybody else here, apparently. So we'll just let him get on with it. It's fine.
Hang on, wait. Kevin, sometimes we have to wrap this up. So, Kevin, you give your explanation, and Alon, he can do his.
That's not fair.
Go on. What are you worried about? He's got fewer degrees than you.
So, but basically, you've got liquid nitrogen in there, and its critical temperature is... -147.
That's looking at him.
It's -147 degrees Celsius, and when it gets above that temperature, it becomes a gas, and no amount of pressure that you put on it can reduce it back to a liquid. And it's inside a sealed container, so the volume that it suddenly occupies exceeds that of the container, and the container explodes and throws bits of cell all over Adam, and then you can't explain it. So that's to my
round of applause, please.
I knew that.
Alon, marks out 10 for that explanation, please.
Well, he should have asked the audience to explain it.
Get off this paradigm of yours. Is he right?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay, good. Between you, with however many degrees you've got, you've got it right. Adam, thank you very much. That's right, we scare biologists with physics and physicists with biology and everyone with physics teachers. Before he heads off the intensive care unit, I think I'm just going to finish up by just saying a few thanks. A huge round of applause to all my guests tonight. Frank James, Anna Starkey, Kevin Fong, Alon Shahar, Gail Cardew, Adam Rutherford, and of course a big thanks to you guys who came. Give yourself a round of applause. Most of all, though... my thanks go to the Royal Institution team, Jason Carpen, and master of all the demos, Andy Marmory, who you saw wandering around before. Without Andy, the demos don't work in this place. And in fact, we tried some before, they didn't work. All that remains for me now to say is that from me, Alok Jha, and from Science Weekly producer, Jason Fitz, who's there and also makes sure everything happens. Round of applause for him, please. From both of us, it's goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.